A co-author of a report on black women in U.S. politics says the upshot is there is much opportunity as well as much work to be done.
The fact that we're not even on the ballot in so many cases is really a challenge.
On this week's 51%, we'll also define kitchen space south of the border. Then we'll hear from an essayist about the spin on muffin tops outside the kitchen. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Boundary lines lie before me. I cross into the unknown. I try to leave my fears behind.
Higher Heights and the Center for American Women in Politics have released a report entitled The Status of Black Women in American Politics. The report provides an historical outline of black women's struggle for political representation and discusses the current landscape of political leadership for black women across the country, as well as their growing political influence. It demonstrates the need for greater engagement, recruitment, and inclusion of black women in politics and government. The report notes that black women are 7.4% of the U.S. population and 7.8% of the electorate. However, there are only 14 black women in Congress, 2 black women in statewide elected executive office, 241 black women in state legislatures, and 26 black women mayors in cities with populations exceeding 30,000. Kimberly Peeler Allen is a fundraising consultant and co-founder of New York City-based Higher Heights for America. I spoke with her about the report.
So as we started digging, we saw that there's been a lot of research around women of color across the full spectrum, but no one had done a pullout specifically on black women. And the issues of black women are somewhat different from the issues of Latinas or Asian women or South Asian women, just because of the cultural norms and geographic issues and whatnot that make things very specific. So we thought for black women to really understand where we are and what our power is, we really needed to go in and just do an assessment. Where are we? Where have we been? Where have we not been? And then start the conversation as to why. The biggest takeaway for us was the tremendous opportunity that is available because of where we are and where we've had some successes, and then also looking at the changing demographics of the country, and particularly in the South. There's been numerous articles over the last couple of weeks in the New York Times and the Washington Post talking about how the Senate is really hinging on the black electorate. And really, when you look at who comes out from the black electorate, you're looking at black women. So getting women to realize the power that they have, that we can really swing elections, and then more importantly, if we are organized and we're supportive of other, strong black women candidates, we have that potential to really change what decision-making tables look like, because we can bring strong candidates to the ballot and then get them elected.
You have something in here about while black women are better represented among congressional candidates, they're significantly underrepresented as candidates and nominees for statewide offices, and describes that as feeders for getting to a gubernatorial bid, for example. So it seems that in there is where things have to get moving.
Exactly. And we're really focused on elevating black women through the entire pipeline, whether it is getting more women to actually register to vote, getting them to the polls, getting them to engage with the political process beyond just Election Day, and then recruiting, grooming, and supporting candidates, and then also helping them to realize their potential in moving up that ladder. Because we've seen, Representative Karen Bass, who started out very early on, I think, in the city council in L.A., and how she was able to move through various steps and was groomed by her predecessor to take that seat. And we'd like to, women in general want to make sure we have all of the foundations down and we're masters of everything. So that means it takes us a little longer to get to the point where we're ready to run. So helping make sure that we have the support from the city council level and using that as maybe a mayoral feeder, and then using that mayoral feeder to a statewide feeder, to a congressional feeder, or ultimately a Senate feeder. So just really looking at strategically, now that we have the sense of where we are, and looking at the 240 women that are in the state legislatures across the country, how many of them are possibly term limited and need someplace else to go, or who have great potential and a willingness to take that next step, and helping them achieve that.
It is mentioned, you know, in your summary here that Black women tend to represent the less affluent districts in a given area of a state, which presents its issues for fundraising.
Yes.
So what do you do here?
As a political fundraiser by training or by practice, I always tell candidates and potential candidates that you have to start running before you start running. And then also we have to change the mindset and really get Black women and people in general to have a sense of political stewardship and looking at, you know, Black women are a great source of philanthropic support, whether it is through their church, their nonprofits that they support, et cetera, but they don't necessarily make that same commitment to political giving. And working to change that mindset, as well as supporting the candidates and making sure that they're well trained as to how to effectively fundraise and use their networks, their churches, their sororities, talking to people about the issues and getting them to understand that it's not just an investment in the person, but it's an investment in the community.
Where are Black women doing well in politics, and where is the biggest room for improvement?
Well, I think there are a few places where things have where we've done well, where we've had members of Congress that have succeeded each other. Ohio is an example. Wisconsin is also an example. But then there's also places like there isn't a Black woman on the Houston City Council. You know, in a city as diverse as Houston, you would think. As well as in Michigan, you look at the state legislature where there are, I believe, three Black women in the state legislature. Two of them are term limited that will be out at the end of this year. And then California is in a similar situation in the state Senate, and two of the three Black women are also term limited this year, and it looks like their seats are going to be replaced by Black men. So it's a matter of really looking at succession planning and really thinking things through and being ready to run when the opportunity presents itself.
How has having an Obama presidency and First Lady Michelle Obama helped or hindered having Black women run or get elected to various offices?
You know, in looking at the numbers as to where we have run and where we have been running, there has been a steady uptick in our involvement since 1996. You look at the members of the Black women in the Congressional Black Caucus, and the majority of them have come in since 1993. So I think having the president and the first lady as such prominent figures has definitely helped, but I think the motivation has been there and just has continued to build.
What else about the report stands out?
I think one of the things that really stood out for me was the challenge that we're having at the statewide level, and that it's not even, we only have two women that are elected statewide, and Black women statewide in the country, but the fact that we're not even on the ballot in so many cases is really a challenge, because it's one thing when you say, okay, well, we've had, you know, on the congressional level, we've had a slew of candidates, and some of them haven't made it through, but to not even have us have that ballot access was really disturbing, and, you know, really made me want to think further about how do we increase this particular pipeline, because it's just it's so narrow, and we've had so few successes and so few opportunities. How do we effectively groom women or groom Black women to really be able to step into that, into those positions? And I think there's a challenge with party structure and donor support and people saying, well, this other person has been waiting in line, or it's not your turn, or you're better off doing X. And through the conversations that we've had kind of anecdotally with candidates and electeds across the country who have considered running statewide, a lot of them have said that they were discouraged by party leaders or the political infrastructure to take that leap. And there are a few who have bucked that system. I think of State Senator Nina Turner out in Ohio, who's running for Secretary of State, and nobody asked her to run. She just decided that that was something that she was going to do, and she was committed to it. And then she put together her plan as to how she thinks that she will win in November, and she sold the party leaders on that. And they, they recognized the power of the Black woman's vote and what she would bring to the overall statewide ticket, and they are now supporting her. But without doing all of that due diligence, she wasn't going to get there, where others have probably said, well, I think I'm going to run for governor, and they've never run for elected office before. So it's just a matter of making sure that we do do everything that we need to do, dot every I, cross every T, and have all of our ducks in a row before we jump out there to really convince people that we can do this.
How important is it to have a role model or a leader when you're starting out on the lower levels of politics, so to speak? And, I've just heard all along that no matter if it's science, math, politics, that women need to have strong role models, that they prove very helpful, very fruitful. And, is this something that you consider in grooming, as you were saying, Black women for the feeder positions moving up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As we've been talking to Black women electeds across the country, so many of them say that they had a terrific role model, that someone that they looked up to. It may not have even been someone in their state, but they had someone that they knew or had some sort of relationship with that was able to at least serve as an inspiration, even if they weren't able to provide any direct encouragement. But it was just very important for them. And then there's on the other hand, there's so many who have said, well, I didn't know anybody. I didn't see anybody like me. I just knew that I needed to do this. And that made it that much harder. We had a call a few weeks ago with some supporters of Higher Heights, and on that call were three state senators from three different states. And to hear them, they almost took over the call and had like their own conversation, just because they were, I think each of them were like one of three in their body. So to be able to talk to other women who were in their same position, and they started talking about the challenges that they were having in their legislature, and somebody else knew about some great package that another member had put forward, and they were able to encourage each other and provide that support. And it just was so critical. And it was, for those of us who were not elected on that call, it was really inspiring to hear them talking to each other about, just having that network. And we talk a lot about, just pick up the phone, making sure that we connect elected officials across the country, because so many of them they think that they're the only ones, or, they're one of two, and they don't realize that there's 241 others in state legislatures across the country. And if they are able to be in contact with each other and pick up that phone and say, I know that they're beating you up, but keep going, this is what you need to do, is just so critically important.
That was Kimberly Peeler Allen, co-founder of the New York City-based Higher Heights for America, which, along with the Center for American Women in Politics, has just issued a report entitled The Status of Black Women in American Politics. It's a report, she says, that is spawning additional research.
But this is definitely some groundbreaking research that that needed to be done, and we're looking forward to using it as a springboard to additional reports, because as you read through it, there's all sorts of other questions about, you know, what are the perceptions of black women candidates? What is the impact of black women candidates? Where can we really run additional black women? So by using this as kind of a groundwork, we're going to be releasing five other pieces of research over the next 18 months that have all kind of come out of questions that have arisen as we were working on this piece.
In 2010, PLR Allen was named to the Crain's New York Business 40 Under 40 list, as well as one of the Feminist Press's 40 Under 40, The Future of Feminism.
And tell my love what not to worry. My love will conquer hate. Every day sing a song of praise. We've come this far by
We now turn from women populating the ballots to populating a space not just for eating. Before Mexico suffered a 2-1 defeat to the Netherlands in the round of 16 in the World Cup in June, many of the country's passionate soccer fans partook not only in cheering on their team, but in enjoying traditional cuisine. And Lilia Fuchin reports that perhaps the strongest pillar of Mexican community is the women who gather to cook traditional foods.
Throughout Mexico, if you're up before dawn and near a kitchen, you'll probably hear this sound. Women rise early and often in an outdoor kitchen, pat a fresh batch of tortillas into shape, and cook them for breakfast. Mexico's culinary customs fascinate author Maria Elisa Christie, who has a particular fondness for tamales.
And there's just so much ritual around the tamales. It's very difficult to make them. You know, there's traditions such as tying little, they call them ears. They tie little ears with the strips of the corn husk on the sides of the pot. And they say that's so that they won't hear anything. They won't hear anything bad. They won't hear noise. They won't hear any fighting, anything that would disrupt the love that they need to be cooked in.
And when it comes to cooking, everything that is not meat is done by women.
I found one celebration that everybody told me, oh, you have to come see. This is the day that the men cook. But even there, the women were there to give what they called, they said only women have sazon. Only women have the right, you know, flavoring. So the men were there chopping and whatever. But it's large groups of women, maybe 5 to 8 groups of women in circles working for days.
In her book, Kitchen Space, Women, Fiestas, and Everyday Life in Central Mexico, Christie explores the physical spaces of kitchens.
And the kitchen spaces in America are where people prepare food are indoors. They have a refrigerator, you know, a sink with running water. And what I came to call kitchen spaces in Mexico were places where food was prepared, but sometimes it was fully outdoors with a pile of firewood and huge clay pots. They're called cazuelas.
But the most important role of the Mexican kitchen just might be the part it plays in building community.
One of the women there had just lost her granddaughter, and that was such an important soothing space for them to be with her in the 3 or 4 days of preparation, but it was very sad.
Christie is the program director of Women and International Development at Virginia Tech. While she was raising her children in Mexico, she got to spend a lot of time with the grandmothers of the community.
They'd say, you can't cook when you're angry, because then your food will be spoiled and it will make people sick. So you have to put love into your food. And they'll tell stories of, you know, how they learned from their grandmothers. And the young people will say, you know, my grandmother would send me away just at the time that she would put in the final ingredients because she wasn't ready to pass on the, you know, the mole recipe.
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Lilia Fuchin.
Writer Dr. Jerry Burns tops off this week's show with her view on word choice. It's all in how we spin it.
Just think about warm, fresh, out-of-the-oven muffins. Their delicate scent can swallow the whole kitchen. Tasty and sweet, muffins are desirable, happy delights for carbo, gluten, dairy tolerant people. But that's not all. Muffins have muffin tops. Torn from the muffin bottoms, their crunchy shells and feathery interiors are savored first or saved for last by hardcore muffin top lovers. But muffin tops on human wastes are not so popular. The only thing they have in common with the desire for a baked muffin top is the desire to rip them off. The Urban Dictionary provides one of its memorable hip definitions and usage examples for muffin top. Here's the definition. When a woman wears a pair of tight jeans that makes her flab spill out over the waistband, just like the top of a muffin sits over the edge of the paper case. Here's the usage example. Geez, check out the muffin top on that chick. Shudder. Yes, the word shudder is part of the usage example, just after the sentence, kind of like a word-based emoticon. If the Urban Dictionary can be said to provide definitions of culture, then the word shudder tells you just how muffin tops are perceived. And because of this distaste for human muffin tops, people try to exorcise them away. People try to hide them behind sweaters. People try not to grow them because culture frowns on pounds. Culture shudders. But who exactly decides what things are desirable or shudder-worthy? I recently saw a YouTube video that reminded me how anybody can have that power and decide these things for themselves. Anyone can choose the spin. It's in the words we choose and the attitude we use when we write or say them. That's what makes all the difference. The video was by Erin Keeney, a mama who raps with pride about her muffin top. It is her badge of parenting, and her video is awesome. Writers, storytellers, parents, teachers, well, just about anyone can learn from her example. In the muffin top rap, Erin tells about how her muffin tops were born. She raps about her fighting efforts to vanquish her opponent with Rocky-style commitment. Ultimately, she gives up muffin top fighting. But not in despair. Erin turns the whole thing around and embraces her muffin top. Erin takes joy in her muffin top. Her winsome, winning video gives me joy in muffin tops, too. You see, we don't have to accept every image that is put forth in the media. We can take control of the images and how we represent them and how we use our words. We can change the connotations associated with words and phrases. It's all in how we spin it. Sure, muffin tops can remain hidden in the cupboard of our bulky knits. Or we can shout from the rooftops and proudly shake them like Erin does. Anybody can shake up societal expectations with the words they use. Muffin tops are a fact of life for many people, especially for those of us in the Mama Club. Next time I look with disdain in the mirror, I think I'll go watch Erin's video instead. If we carry our muffin tops with joy like she does, we won't create dreaded fear of muffin tops for future generations. If we teach children to shudder, they will shudder. If we reinforce the shudder, anyone, not just children, will have distaste for themselves and for others. That's why we need to spin it ourselves. Let's choose our words carefully. Let's choose the way we utter them. Let's choose to shatter the shudder with the words we utter.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com or visit her at storytellingmatters.wordpress.com. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1304. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%.